Anaximander, from the Lives of Eminent Philosophers, translated by R.D. Hicks for the Loeb edition. Anaximander, the son of Praxiades, was a native of Miletus. He laid down as his principle and element that which is unlimited without defining it as air or water or anything else. He held that the parts undergo change, but the whole is unchangeable. He was the first inventor of the sundial, in order to mark the solstices and equinoxes, from which he also constructed clocks to tell the time. He was the first to draw on a map the outline of land and sea. There is a story that the boys laughed at his singing, and that when he heard of it, he rejoined, "Then to please the boys, I must improve my singing."
When the night has come and the land is dark and the moon is the only light we'll see, no, I won't be afraid. Oh, I won't be afraid, just as long as you stand by me. So darling, darling, stand by me. Oh, stand by me. Oh, stand by me. Stand by me.
Anaximander, Under the Bridge, 1957. The man who lived under the bridge looked like the troll my mother had told me about in the fairy tale. His hair was long, unkempt, and stuck out all around like a shrub, and usually had dirt and leaf bits and twigs in it. His beard framed his sunburned face like a bush of hair, also grown out very long, also unkempt, uncut, and contained portions of meals he had eaten. His face, surrounded by this density, this aura of excited chaos, looked like that of a green man. I thought this only later, of course, much later when I was middle-aged, and saw such a face on the carved door of a 12th-century abbey in England. And in fact, I immediately thought it was his face. So much like his face it was, I had to wonder what I had seen when I was a 10-year-old boy, who that man was, why he was there, and it reminded me vividly of the summer when, but I'm getting ahead of myself. His face inside this shrubbery of hair and beard looked exactly like this green man, embrangled in his foliate fret. Something not at all Christian for a Christian church to display, nor something decorous and classical like a Greek satyr would be, but something more ancient and more primitive, more savage. Something feared or cautionary, perhaps, feral, with a human face, caught in the wild of green growth, its body sucked into the dense entanglement of leaf and vine, its soul captured, and his eyes, popping wide and bright, peeking out helplessly at me with startled wonder at what they saw. Eyes that stopped your own thoughts with the inarticulate thought they held in them. And yet, as I think of it now as an adult, not with a child's mind, I think he was not menacing us. I think he delighted to see us children come under the bridge. But we were always frightened of him, and seeing him, we always ran away. Of course, truthfully, that was the reason we went looking for him, to be frightened. Every time we found him under the bridge, we ran away. Sometimes, We saw him in the alleys behind our houses, looking through garbage cans and taking things out of them. Sometimes we saw him walking along the river, among the weeds there, also stooping and looking for things and picking through things and putting them into his overcoat. He always wore an overcoat, even when it was hot. I think the coat had many pockets. We had names for him. We called him the Garbage Man, not so cleverly. We also called him the Troll, the Bum, Stinky, you can guess why, Einstein, because his hair was frizzy and exploded from his head like that goofy scientist whose picture we had seen in Life magazine. And this was funny because Einstein was supposed to be a genius, but he looked like a retard. Saint Anthony, because one of us was doing his Catholic catechism at the time, and the booklet he was always studying had a picture in it of this saint who looked a lot like him. Uncle Looney Tunes, or Uncle Looney for short. Sad Sack, which my father called him. And then my own pet name for him, Pockets. Once we went down under the bridge, and though we called him all the names we had for him, he did not poke out. He must be gone. We found underneath the bridge he had made a lean-to shelter. Blocked and framed with plywood sheets, he must have scrounged from some new house site. And propped up against the inside of the bridge on the bank above the river, one sheet for a roof with big rocks on it to hold it down. We went inside, and though it was dark, we saw he had an old mattress and some clothes in the dirt, and other junk piled against one side, and a box turned over for a table. And as our eyes got used to the dim light, we saw the walls were wallpapered with pasted pages of magazines, overlapping as in a quixotic collage, layer upon layer of chance or meaning, madness or purpose. The significance of their organization was not apparent, but some pictures had been drawn upon with lipstick or something else that was vividly red. In some cases to accentuate a feature, in others to obliterate one. And there were words, phrases actually, texts of thought. Not sentences, but strung together like sentences ought to be and enjoined by arrows, equal signs, dashes, lines linking clusters of words by long arcs and mazy ways, expressing some poetic algebra of abstraction and imagination. We really had no time to read or solve it because he appeared, and we ran like hell to get out of there. He said nothing, but I felt that he watched us run away. I know I was a strange little boy, but I don't know why I was. And I didn't think I was strange at the time, and my mother or father never seemed to think there was anything strange about me. But I started fishing when I was about 4 years of age. It was my father that taught me. But it was unusual, I think. And now that I had children of my own, it seems obviously abnormal that I habitually, even obsessively, got up early in the morning and went out to the river to fish, alone, almost since I was out of diapers. And my parents never worried about it, or at least never said anything to me about it. Every day after school, I went fishing. Every Saturday, all day long, I fished. On Sundays, my mother tried to make me go to Mass with her, but otherwise, if my dad got up first, he took me fishing with him. During the summer, I fished all the time. I don't think I was ever without my rod in my hand or didn't have it nearby. I used anything I could for bait and tried almost anything I could find. Worms, of course, grasshoppers, frogs. Corn niblets from a can, a trick pocket, showed me that really was good for crappies. and some sort of made-up flies which I invented with wads of bubblegum, which sometimes actually worked on smallmouth bass when the weather was steamy and the water was nasty. But I had my friends, too, and they went with me, and we just roved together along the river and by the slough north of the development around our houses, beyond the city park and the bandstand and the picnic grounds, back where there were no houses ever built because it was so soupy and full of mosquitoes. And rumor was that a little girl had got murdered and buried there, or so Sissy Peterson said. Sissy Peterson, actually a fat kid and the biggest amongst us and a good in a fight. And Bill, my best friend, and Keith, whom we called Mouth because he had a big mouth like that guy in the movies who made a sound like an air raid siren going off. These were my buddies. These were the guys I went with to spy on pockets or to fish. Though Mouth never fished, but sat with us anyway. And these were the guys I slept outside summer nights with and talked about sex and stars. I mean the ones in the sky, not the movie stars. And who's the best cowboy, Gene Autry or Roy Rogers or Hopalong? Things like that. Actually, we did not talk about sex since we had no idea what that was. But we talked about seeing naked girls or wanting to see naked girls. And not having any naked girls to see, we usually just teased each other by getting naked ourselves after midnight when we camped out and running around outside Ella Diane's house just in case she might be looking out her bedroom window. That was sex, as far as we were concerned. At least, it felt naughty. My hometown was not big or small. Was smack in the middle of the USA by a river of middling size, a river that ran into one of the world's greatest rivers, but was itself not so big you could not swim across it. And it wandered in the farmlands around us in lazy loops, like a cooked spaghetti noodle that fell on the linoleum. We had an arsenal plant in town that had employed a lot of people during the war, and even after the war because of Korea, and then because of the communist threat generally, but about this time it was widely rumored that it was going to shut down, and a lot of families were thinking of moving out, and some had. My dad talked about it. My mom did not want to because she grew up in the town, and although her mom and dad were dead, before I was born, even. They were buried there in the church cemetery, and she worried about who would tend their graves, she said. A lot of new houses had been built up for all the workers at the plant during the war, and some of those stood empty now. And my dad guessed he would have a hard time selling this one. I did not want to move. My best friends lived there, but my dad was already looking for work in other towns. We had a pretty good-sized downtown, some buildings even 4 or 5 stories high. The bank was magnificent, a marble Greek temple with Corinthian columns and all that goes with it, busts of philosophers and bankers, gilded cages for the tellers. The library, one of the Carnegie libraries, had a central Tiffany stained-glass atrium, with 3 flights of scrollwork, wrought iron, scaffold bookshelves around it. The librarian sat under a sign that said, "Information, please." We had one of those new strip malls out where we lived in the suburbs of town, which we could get to by bikes, and bought Cokes and candy bars there. We lived out in a large housing tract development not too far from the city park where they held the county fair each year and near the new bridge that they had built. The bridge, on the road running back to town via our suburban strip mall, was built on account of the new housing tract as well as to facilitate traffic to the city or county park. But neither the park nor the bridge drew much traffic, in large part because the housing development had petered out. There were many vacant lots around here and undeveloped woods, and an empty cul-de-sac of vacant lots at one side of the bridge with a new asphalt top and concrete curbs and a new streetlight, but no one was building there. Some houses in construction had, in fact, stopped being built in the middle of construction. Getting rained on, the insides of their skeletal frames being ruined and left for bankruptcy. The bridge was therefore something of a boondoggle, spanking new and very few cars crossing it. Maybe a couple an hour is all. It was, however, a great place for us kids, a castle. Wooded all around it and remote, good for all kinds of mischief and imagination. And it was great for fishing, especially underneath it, in its cool shadows where the eddies draw fish in the calms behind the pilings. I fished all the time. My earliest memory is fishing. I was 4, I think, and I remember standing at the bed of my parents while they slept, the sun coming up, misty through the open summery windows, and I remember the smell of the room being full of very ripe fruit, I thought at the time. I know better now. And I think I must have been trying to wake my dad to get him to take me fishing. I had on my PJs with the cowboys and Indians on them and wearing my cowboy hat with the string chin band with the sliding wooden bead at the end, looped around my neck, hanging off my back. I went to the garage and got the rod myself and hooks from my dad's tackle box and lead sinkers out of the coffee can and took myself to the river to fish on my own. Don't remember anything else about it, really, but as I say, my parents were never concerned about my going off alone like that, even when I was so young. I can't imagine being that way about my own kids. As I got older, I remember my dad taking me out in boats to fish, which is where I prefer fishing now rather than casting from the shore, although I might try my hand at trout fishing someday. Funny, I never have. My dad had a 12-foot aluminum rowboat, which he kept on a trailer beside the garage. His outboard motor, a green Mercury Mark V with speed control knob on the steering handle, a top carrying handle, and depressed lettering, painted red, in a silvery aluminum band around the fuel tank rim. He kept slung on the sawhorse on the back of the garage by his workbench, when not on the boat. My dad let me steer when we were out in the open water. We never wore life jackets, as I remember. Again, something I would not do with my own kids. What was that? I mean, didn't kids drown back in those days? Actually, as I recall it very well, one summer around that time there was a little kid that drowned, swimming out at the city park in the river when an undertow got him. It was in the papers. And I knew him from school, though I did not know him well because he was younger than me. And generally, you didn't make friends with kids not about your own age. Anyway, we had a holy mass for him at church, and my mom took me and made my dad come too, and I had to wear a tie and a white shirt. Couldn't wait to get it off and go fishing when I got out of there. His casket was in the front by the altar. That was the first time I'd seen such a small casket, and it was creepy, thinking that they made caskets for little kids, like they expected us to die. My mom would not let me out of the house when we got home. My mom was not happy. Most of the time she was alone in the house, and I don't know what she did all day. I guess she cleaned and cooked and stuff, but she didn't bake bread and pies and things, and as I remember it, we mostly ate hot dogs and beans and macaroni and cheese. So I don't know what she did with her time. She didn't really have any friends. And we only had one car, and Dad took that to work every day. So what did she do? My days were the same every day. I got up early and went fishing. I went to school if I had to. I came home and went fishing. When I got older, I spent a lot of time with Sissy, Bill, and Mouth, but still, I mostly went fishing. What my mom was doing, I did not know. Or think about, I guess. Although, as I said, I thought she was sad. Of course, as an adult, I understand what I, as a child, did not see or could not see or could not understand at the time. What adults do, the things they think children know nothing about. They quarreled one night. It woke me up. About me, I thought. Mom wanted me to get confirmed, and Dad thought it was crap. He said to her that it did no one any good at Iwo Jima, which I did not understand. And my mom said she should not think of her babies gone that way, which I also did not understand. But she was crying, and I think she threw something at him and called him some name I did not understand, and can't really remember except the violence of it, and I heard the screen door slam and guessed my dad had gone out again. He often did when they argued like this at night. They often argued on the weekends and when they had drinks. My mom came into the doorway of my room, which was open, I remember now. I did not like to sleep in the dark. But they always insisted on closing the door and leaving me in the bedroom in the dark, but I would get out of bed after they'd gone down the hall and open the door. The hallway light was on, and she stood at the doorway looking at me as I was pretending to be asleep in bed. I saw her through my squinched-up eyes. She said, "Honey?" And then just closed the door gently and went back down the hall. And when I got up and opened the door again, I could hear her crying in the living room. That was about the time that I met Pockets by myself. I had seen him before, of course, with my friends, and even sometimes alone. And this was, I think, the second summer in a row that he was living there by the river, having somehow survived there over the winter, I don't know how. My dad said he was a sad sack, and there was a cartoon in the papers called Sad Sack, but I could never see the resemblance. As I later came to understand the term as he meant it, it should intimate that he was a vet who had gone loopy during or after the war and couldn't find work, or nobody would hire him anyway because he was so crazy, dirty, and smelly. But at the time, for me, the name Pockets made more sense because he was always putting things into his pockets, and he had so many pockets. It was about this time that we became friends.